The 1997 Sun Stone Symposium presents session number 123, Mormonism in Babylon, The Whore and the Bride, by Lisa Bickmore, with comments by Marissa Januzzi.
I'd like to welcome you to the Sun Stone Symposium session. It is titled Mormonism in Babylon, The Whore and the Bride. Our presenter, Lisa Bickmore, works as a teacher of English at the Salt Lake City Community College. Her first book of poems, Haste, was published in 1994, and it's by Signature Press. She's been working on various writing projects, including a study of the late poet James Merrill, and does work in radical pedagogy, a new book of poems, and various pieces of cultural analysis, including her paper today. She lives in West Jordan with her five children. And commenting on her paper is Marissa Januzzi, who is an assistant professor of English at the University of Utah. Marissa is also doing work on the modernist poet Mina Loy, an avant-garde writer. She is a volunteer at the Cathedral of the Madeleine, and she's going to tell us a little bit more about her work there and what her perspective on this subject is in connection with her Catholic background. We welcome you all. If you have not registered, please do so.
I have truncated my title so that it's now just Mormonism in Babylon, and I can't even explain any more about it than that. It has two epigraphs, the paper does. The first is from Bruce McConkie, Mormon Doctrine. I don't know if it's on. It's doing something over there, so maybe if I speak louder, will that work? Okay. So the first epigraph, apostasy. See abominations, agnosticism, anathema, antichrists, atheism, blasphemy, broad-mindedness, card-playing, celibacy, Christendom, christening, Christianity, Christmas, Church of the Devil, clinic baptisms, creeds, damnation, dark ages, darkness, devil, doctrine, excommunication, extreme unction, fallen man, false Christs, false gods, gambling, Gnosticism, God is a spirit, gospel hobbies, government of God, hell, heresy, idolatry, ignorance, infant baptism, inquisitions, kingcraft, man of sin, ministerial titles, murderers, mythology, obedience, persecution, philosophy, polytheism, priestcraft, profanity, rebellion, religious syncretism, reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, restoration of the gospel, righteousness, scattering of Israel, second coming of Christ, secret combinations, sex, immorality, shrines, sign of the cross, signs of the times, sin, sons of perditions, sorcery, spiritualism, telestial law, temptation, unknown God, war, wickedness, witchcraft, worship of images. That's the second edition of Mormon Doctrine. The second epigraph is from the Marquis de Sade, Juliette. You will be obliged to acknowledge that woman is simply man in an extraordinarily degraded form. 1. Fables of Origin. While Bruce McConkie asserts that the whole history of the world has been one recurring instance of personal and group apostasy after another, most of us who were raised as Mormons will probably read the list of subjects related to the general topic apostasy just cited as encoding one of the major episodes in Mormon mythic historiography, the Great Apostasy, the period after the death of Christ, after which the Apostolic Fathers had the fate of Christianity in their hands and came up with the beginnings of Catholicism. The meanings of Catholicism to Mormonism is the subject of my paper. I want to investigate those meanings first by looking particularly at the ways that Mormon theology and mythology account for Mormonism's origins, than the necessary agon that those origins pose with high churches, particularly Catholicism, and finally at the ways that those accounts are implicated in a practice of worship. Mormonism has long claimed for itself a special place in the history of religion, perhaps from its very beginnings. Its first and most evident story of origin is that of a revelation, an appearance of gods and angels to a young man with the news of a new true church that would abolish all existing ones as only partially or else blatantly untrue. Yet nearly simultaneously with the iteration of this first myth is the powerful story of a restoration, Mormonism claiming to restore the early relations of the God of Moses to man, and thus to restore an ancient patriarchy. What both of these stories share is a claim of utter originality. No other church like the revealed Church of Jesus Christ, no other church like the restored religion of Adam, Abraham, and Moses. One thing that seems clear in looking at the much-researched context in which Mormonism made its first appearance is that there were so many other churches that the necessity of establishing the criteria for understanding the defining differences became crucial. The generally Protestant character of those churches perhaps presented itself as the first point of difference. A Protestant church establishes its identity by means of critiquing or protesting the character of a prior church. Thus, a Protestant church can never wholly claim originality because its origin is dependent upon a prior other. By claiming revelation and restoration, Mormonism doubly protects itself from the problematic original other. It effectively does away with any other because, as revealed, it is wholly new, and in a neat move, it is simultaneously so old there could be no prior other. Or so goes the story we've written and told to explain ourselves to ourselves and to others. Yet these two accounts of origin that explain so much also leave much unarticulated. Harold Bloom, in his The American Religion, suggests that the followers of Joseph Smith, quote, for at least a century now, have backtracked from his radical newness to a public stance sometimes difficult to distinguish from Protestantism, unquote. Perhaps it is that awkward moment when the Mormons begin to look uncomfortably like Protestants that predicates the power of these myths. I cannot offer historians evidence of this, but one might locate certain assimilationist tendencies in Mormonism quite early on. The maintenance of difference as a key to identity becomes more and more difficult to muster when the necessity of edging closer and closer to the norm exerts its powerful counter-argument. One way that Mormons began this shift in identity was to adopt the ethos of Reformation. Again, I cannot locate a precise moment when this may have begun, but it seems quite clear that in the early part of this century, the idea of a great apostasy as a fundamental point of deviation from a true original church gathered a certain consensus, so that even people who saw themselves at odds theologically, like B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith, agreed on this point, that the apostolic church had apostatized and that the resulting churches had become corrupt and untrue. Roberts and Smith had meticulous theological arguments to demonstrate this. But there was another argument that connected the Mormon project of differentiation with a Protestant project of reformation, and that had more to do with practices of worship than with articles of belief or professions of creed. I speak, of course, of the characterization of the Roman Catholic Church as the great and abominable church, the church of the devil, the harlot of the world, the whore of Babylon, in her clothing and behaviors exemplifying the worst tendencies of the high church, pride, pageantry, paganism, and excess. Elaine Pagels, in The Origin of Satan, reminds us that Martin Luther, quote, denounced as agents of Satan all Christians who remained loyal to the Roman Catholic Church, unquote. So this is a founding move of Protestantism, to identify the Roman Catholic Church with Satan, with a succession of figures, including this one, the whore, that spin out from that identification. Mormonism, in participating in this rhetoric, associates itself powerfully, then, with the reformist project. The question is why? What strength does Mormonism gain by giving up its previous position of what Bloom calls radical newness and simultaneous original ancientness? In order to answer this question, we must think through the figure of the whore. This is a complicated project and risks an ahistoricism that sometimes typifies theological thinking. I want to look at a number of scriptural texts, both biblical and Book of Mormon, that seem to connect in elucidating this,
this figure for us. But in some ways, this exegesis risks begging the question of the specific connection to the 19th and 20th century Mormon church. I hope to link the exegesis to an important, widely available, and popular Mormon text, Bruce McConkie's Mormon Doctrine, by way of showing how the figure of the whore serves usefully to make a critique not only of Catholic doctrine, but also Catholic worship, thus preserving a useful criterion of difference. 2. A very bad woman and her uses. Camille Paglia, in her Sexual Personae, records an interesting episode from the early days of Catholicism. St. Augustine, writing at a turning point in Western culture, circa 415 AD, calls the rites of Cybele obscene, shameful, filthy, the mad and abominable revelry of effeminates and mutilated men. If these are sacred rites, what is sacrilege? If this is purification, what is pollution? The great mother has surpassed all her sons, not in greatness of deity, but of crime. Cybele is a monster, imposing a deformity of cruelty on her castrated priests. And then this is Paglia again. The great mother, like Rome herself, is the whore of Babylon. Others have commented on the tendency to demonize, particularly Pagels in her book on Satan. What's interesting here is that the figure of evil for Augustine is a corrupt mother, not male but female. So it went with the reformers, most notably with Luther. The church played the harlot when it should have been a faithful and virginal bride. They saw in the book of Revelations a woman, and then I'm quoting now from Revelations, arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness and other fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. That's in chapter 17. This woman was available for interpretation. Given the reformist critique of Catholicism, the key to interpreting her was obvious. Part of what makes her so easily identifiable for the Protestants is the detail with which she is described. She has an inscription on her forehead, but even more telling is the description of her apparel. This almost certainly connects with the description that Isaiah gives of the daughters of Zion in chapter 3. They walk with stretched forth necks, I'm quoting, and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go and making a tinkling with their feet. Surely the reformers saw themselves as on the Lord's side in finding fault with the ornament and excess of the Catholic Church, since the Lord himself promised to take away from the harlot-like daughters of Zion, quote, the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet, the chains and the bracelets and the mufflers, the bonnets, the ornaments of the legs, the headbands and the tablets and the earrings, the rings and nose jewels, the changeable suits of apparel, the mantles and the wimples and the crisping pins, the glasses and the fine linens, and the hoods and the veils. These details are telling, if only in a certain kind of interpretation. That interpretation focuses upon visible cues, the representative objects, icons, and images that identify a woman as a wanton, a harlot, or a whore. The question these representations don't answer is, why a woman? Why represent the church, one of the great fathers, as a woman? What kinds of critique does this move make available? Naomi Shore, in her book Reading in Detail, suggests one possibility. She argues that the detail has always been gendered, that is, that Western culture has, quote, a long-time association of the order of the small, the finely wrought and the Heimlich, with the feminine sphere. She also points out what hardly needs reiterating, that the feminine sphere has also been almost without fail devalorized and degraded in the hierarchy of values of Western culture. Thus, we might see in the attention to details of clothing and adornment that obsess these scriptural passages a kind of misogyny that is located in the detail. Paglia also has a useful perspective here on the power of the image and its status as suspect within the Judeo-Christian project. And I quote, paganism is pictorialism plus the will to power. It is ritualism, grandiosity, colossalism, sensationalism. All theater is pagan showiness, the brazen pomp of sexual personae. Judaism's campaign to make divinity invisible has never fully succeeded. While Paglia does not explicitly here link the realm of the image with the female, she does consistently, in her book, associate paganism and its persistent vestiges with the Great Mother, the antithesis of the one God of Judaism. What Shore suggests and Paglia reinforces is that interpreting these available figures of whores as Catholicism allows for a vigorous and vociferous critique of the visual image and its details. this potential has resonance for Mormonism and its sacred and popular texts. The Book of Mormon, for instance, takes up a familiar strain. In chapter 13 of 1 Nephi, Nephi sees in vision, quote, "This great and abominable church, and I saw the devil that he was the founder of it. And I also saw gold and silver and silks and scarlets and fine twined linen and all manner of precious clothing." You can see the connections there between the Isaiah passages. "And I saw many harlots. And the angels spake unto me, saying, Behold, the gold and the silver and the silks and the scarlets and the fine twined linen and the precious clothing and the harlots are the desires of this great and abominable church." In this Mormon text, we see a continuity with the canonized scripture of the Christian world in identifying the corrupt church of the world with the representable image, the details of costly clothing linked with harlots. Again, while this passage does not explicitly name the great and abominable church as a whore or even as a woman, in the details, we can certainly link this discussion with those of Isaiah and the Revelator. Through the details of clothing and apparel, we make the synecdochic connection. Bruce McConkie is an exponent of this figure and its traditional interpretations. He discusses the problematic nature of images in Mormon doctrine. For instance, in the article on idolatry, he says, "Idol worship prevails among nearly all uncivilized pagan peoples, and also, to a degree and in a sense, among portions of those who are supposedly enlightened by Christianity and modern civilization. Men cannot gain salvation by worshiping idols, images, or false gods of any kind." And in the article on worship of images, McConkie has this to say. According to their own official statement, Catholics, and he italicizes this next two words, worship images. Not just false gods or a concept of deity which is false and untrue, but out and out, plain and simply stated, they worship the actual images of so-called saints, which are everywhere found in their cathedrals and other buildings. He goes on to quote from the Catholic Encyclopedia, qualifying his own statement by the more nuanced account in the Encyclopedia of the place images hold in Catholic worship. For instance, the Encyclopedia is quoted as saying, "We do not pray to relics or images, for they can neither see nor hear nor help us." Yet McConkie is insistent. Quote, "In spite of this formal assertion that the worship of images should not include the offering of prayers to them, it is well known that in practice great hosts of Catholics have prayed and do now pray to the image itself." And he reiterates one more time, quote, "It is, of course, well understood that Catholic prayers are addressed to the saint before whose image the worshiper kneels, with the hope that such saint will intercede with Mary and with the Lord." Finally, in the entry on shrines, McConkie expresses special disgust for the images and objects found in the shrines of pagans and of other religions. Again, italicized. "Shrines play no part in true worship. The saints go to temples and meeting houses, kneel before holy altars, perform sacred ordinances, and are there taught the doctrines of salvation. But they do not worship at these places because some holy being has once stood there, or because a bone or a hank of hair of a dead person has been exhumed and is there displayed. True worship does not depend upon the place of devotion, but upon the righteousness of the worshiper." None of these passages in McConkie's text focus explicitly on the woman as a whore, figured as a great and abominable church. Yet, the resonance of those early scriptural texts and their interpretations echoes in his contempt for the image, for the object, for physical details, as corrupt and false. 3. Dread as praxis. One consequence of this strategy of difference is the production of dread, disgust, and contempt. Whatever is other, from a practical standpoint, becomes not only dangerous, but corrupt, degraded, the enemy of truth, dreadful. Here the enemy is the church of the devil, represented by the image, by ornament, by physical detail, which are linked to the relics of the dead. A long hermeneutical tradition links this critique to the figure of the whore and this woman to the Catholic Church. This tradition has its exponents in this century's expositors of Mormon doctrine. What can be the meaning of this production of dread and loathing? What worship praxis issues from dread and loathing? I want to suggest that, like all social practice, Mormon worship is always being constructed, and that one influence on that construction has been a certain antagonistic version of Catholicism, this whorish version I have been sketching. What Mormonism has aimed to do, among many other things, is to eschew this whorishness, pageantry, and ritual. splendor, a fully articulated set of details with a fully articulated set of interpretations of those details, images, and beauty of a vivid or heightened kind. I should at this point make clear that I am speaking of the worship that takes place in Mormon chapels on Sunday, because Mormon temple worship, of course, does have both a historical and a present-day practice of ritual, pageantry, details, and images. But I think it's critical to focus on the everyday worship of Mormons because it's the form of worship that's available to all. Whatever else you might want to say about temple worship, it is restricted and less available. And I find it telling that our most ritualized, heavily detailed, image-laden worship is conducted in a place that is decidedly not open. I say that Mormonism aims to eschew the harlotry of its construction of Catholicism because all antagonistic construction seems to invite the opposite to come calling. But I'd simply like to rehearse some familiar elements of Mormon Sunday worship by showing that this general idea, Mormon worship as oppositional to Catholic or high church worship, is exhibited in a plethora of ways. Much has been written about the architecture of Mormon churches. And particularly in Utah, Mormons have a commonly held sense of what is an appropriate design for a church, and that's partly because there are only a few designs approved centrally at any given moment. The interesting thing is that there seems to be no commonly held theological tradition or hermeneutics to elucidate the meanings of this design. Does a church building represent a body, the body of Christ? One might ask any number of questions about modern Mormon churches and not be able to come up with any commonly held explanations of the meanings of their details. Part of the reason for this, I would suggest, is the marked absence of meaningful detail from the design and decoration of Mormon churches. If there is anything to be interpreted, it is this very lack, which is, I suppose, my project. Mormons have ritual elements built into their worship, although I and many of you were probably told as children that Mormons did not have rituals, partly aimed, I think, at valorizing the practice of extemporaneous prayer as opposed to the high church practice of set prayer. But what constitutes a ritual in the context of an oppositional construction might well have something to do with the matter of degree. This might mean that in practice, though Mormons have sacred rituals, for example, the partaking of bread and water in the sacrament, as part of regular worship service, these rituals are performed in such a way that they don't feel ritualistic. Thus, though Mormon worship always opens with prayer and song and concludes with prayer and song, because the prayers are extemporized and not recited, the prayers do not feel as if they are part of a ritual. And since much of the Mormon worship service is taken up with teaching, a series of talks usually given by lay members, the effect of ritual in Mormon worship might have the general sense of dilution rather than intensity or concentration. In this sense, then, Mormon worship might accurately be said to be ritual poor. The Mormon attitude toward beauty is a tricky subject, since beauty, as the poet has it, is in the eye of the beholder. But in the context of the image of the whore, I think we can develop a rough category of beauty that Mormonism distrusts and sees as the sign of devilishness. I would also say that here is where a misogyny makes its way into our worship praxis. The beauty of the high church, what I'll call for the sake of sensationalism, whorish beauty, is a beauty of images, of fine things, of splendor and opulence, of detail and ornament, and of multiplicity, of excess. In contrast to that, in opposition, is another aesthetic which has to do with the plain, the unornamented and unadorned, the simple, the single eye. There are any number of ways to exemplify this tendency in Mormon worship, but I'd like to focus on music, which is one place where this aesthetic gets worked out. Mormons are congregational hymn singers. Mormons also have ward choirs. There's also a small, developing canon of church music, that is, music sacred, recognizably Mormon, written to be performed by choirs as opposed to congregations. Along with this canon is an aesthetic that is also a set of rules about appropriateness. Most Mormon church music is very simple, and much of it is based on traditional hymns. My understanding from the experience of having been the ward choir director 3 times is that there is an official, that is contained in the bishop's handbook or semi-official, prohibition or caution about performing cantatas, extended works of sacred music, in sacrament meetings. More than once, I also heard discourse from various sources indicating that music from the high church tradition, while beautiful in its own right, was not appropriate for sacrament meeting, where hymns and plain simple music were more appropriately performed. Well, this, of course, doesn't stop rogue choir directors from occasionally performing bits of Messiah, for instance. It does indicate a distrust of this kind of music as a form of worship. I see this aesthetic plainness as embodying a form of misogyny, as I have said earlier. Any number of feminist theorists might point to the ways that the terms for articulating an aesthetic of singularity, simplicity, plainness, connect culturally and ideologically to phallocentrism, whereas an aesthetic of adornment, ornament, detail, excess, or plurality tends to be associated with the feminine. I would point, too, to the epigraph I cited from Sade. Woman is simply man in an extraordinarily degraded form. And given the hermeneutic that Reformationists have used from the very beginning, we might add, the Church of the Devil, the Whore of Babylon, what is she? But a patriarchal church, but in an extraordinarily degraded form. Our worship has been constructed from many sources, and this is only one of them. It's powerful enough, though, to have produced a deep antithesis within our own praxis, one that I think of as the not-Catholic qualities of Mormon worship. Where we put it into discourse, we articulate our worship as plain, lay, simple, true, privileging the Spirit of God and not the image of God. But the shadow side of these traits is their utter dependence upon a negation, upon figuring ourselves as not Catholic, and Catholicism as whorish. How will we come to understand ourselves as Mormons and as Christians in a world where images, ritual, pageantry, beauty in the details are motive forces? How will we know this world in which men and women believe, pray, covenant, and love God through worship that is filled with images and ritual, when our answer historically has been to construct ourselves against this world, and ideologically against this world figured as a woman? What account shall we make of ourselves when our current worship practice continues to enact this agon? What shall we say of ourselves when a significant part of our saying is no? Recognizing the many ways that our worship practice is funded by negation, agon, and othering has the potential of allowing a gradual undoing of the effects I have described above, of opening another way of understanding worship, our relationships with God, our relations as Christians, with all the other pilgrims on their diverse roads back to God's city. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Can you hear me? No, huh? Let's see what I can do here. Is that any better? Pardon? Slightly. Okay, I'll try and keep the voice up. I just want to thank Lisa Bickmore and Rachel Day and Sunstone for giving me a chance to come here and speak to an audience that is completely really new to me. I'm new to Salt Lake City, relatively speaking. Came here from New York City. Might as well tell you a few things about myself so that you can sort of figure out what some of my perspective is sort of deriving from in relation to this topic. I was born Catholic. I am Catholic. I work at the Cathedral of the Madeleine as a volunteer. Plenty of Catholics, though, probably wouldn't own me as Catholic because I've always been very interested in some of the topics that are the most fraught for Catholics, namely the origins of the Church in ancient Greek and pagan culture, aspects of Catholic tradition that have been sort of disowned. I'm interested very much in the theology of ordination, which makes the whole Church nervous right now. So I speak to you kind of as a sort of a renegade but devout Catholic, which is sort of paradox, but here I am, okay? I don't know how typical I am, though on the East Coast I'm probably pretty typical of liberal Catholics who often find themselves just all over the place on questions of, you know, Catholic teaching. When I say Catholic in this paper, I'll tend to refer to Roman Catholic tradition, which is what I know much better than Catholic, Eastern Orthodox forms of Catholicism. I think Lisa Bickmore's paper raises some absolutely fascinating questions about the Mormon relation to Catholic worship practices by way of their investment in the traditional and Protestant equation of the Whore of Babylon of Revelation 17 with the Roman Catholic Church. And this equation is a marker of Catholic Mormon otherness. While I can at best only really ask a few questions about the meaning of the figure of the whore and all her sort of complexity, as Lisa sort of describes her, for Mormon religious experience, I can maybe most usefully dwell on the figure of the whore in relation to my own tradition. And when I say the whore of Babylon, I mean not just the whore as the figure in Revelation 17, as the particular vision of the apocalypse, but also the whore as a sort of image-generating apparatus, right? Namely, all the aspects of Catholic ritual which have the power to generate images and ideas, the smells and bells of my tradition, okay? And what I'm eventually going to argue is, the really interesting and central question here, it seems to me, is do Catholics recognize themselves in this figure of the whore? And I want to argue that if the whore stands in as a figure for the patriarchal church in an extraordinarily degraded form, then she has, on the one hand, useful diagnostic power, a power to articulate some of our own corruptions and troubles as a church. But on the other hand, perhaps she's not such a bad figure. Perhaps one might like to see a patriarchy in extraordinarily degraded form. Perhaps there's something to be salvaged there in this other account of the whore. So I started out by kind of titling my response Reclaiming the Whore, Image Production, Mass Culture, and the Feminine in Catholic Worship Practice. So anyway, first I want to back up and say that one of the things that I thought was most provocative about Lisa's paper is the way she links the figure of the whore to the great mother tradition, the goddess tradition in ancient antiquity. Basically, that the power of this figure of the whore of Babylon comes in Augustine's ability to relate her to mother goddesses like Cybele, basically a Phrygian mother goddess who was a goddess of fertility and presided over one of the most ancient, important mystery cults of antiquity. The worship of Cybele was very well known in Greece at the time that the early Catholic Church was coming together, and it's a form of worship that was strictly regulated by also Roman emperors who finally lifted the constraints against worshiping Cybele, finally found her, not sufficiently threatening either politically or religiously to lift the restraints, but not until well into, the common era. So there's an enormous and huge tradition of mother goddesses which within Christian antiquity has to be sort of displaced in order to make room for the early church. And the great power of Cybele, like the power of the Whore of Babylon, is seen as emasculating specifically to Augustine. You remember that when she quotes Camille Paglia quoting Augustine refers to the castrated priests of the cult of Cybele. And so, here we have this sort of power is specifically gendered and threatening. And so the question becomes sort of why? And it's easy enough to see, if you know a little bit about mystery cults, that the Catholic Church in particular, the Eucharistic meal, the sacrament, basically takes the wheat which was used in the worship of Demeter, another goddess who the Greeks associated with Cybele and the fertility worship. They took the foods from the sacraments of the mother goddess, those meals consecrated by the mother goddess, the wheat that's held aloft to signify the disappearance and reappearance of Persephone in the springtime when the harvest begins to show its little blonde face. It basically, the early church has taken the sacramental foods of pagan antiquity and displaced the maternal goddess aspect, right, of the divinity of these signs. And so it's an extraordinarily touchy kind of, topic for the church fathers, right? It's sort of what are the roots of the Eucharistic meal in pagan antiquity and specifically mother goddess worship? When the mother goddess becomes too powerful, we have to say she's emasculating and she's the whore, and we have to sort of regulate her sort of appearances and worship. So I think that this is sort of fascinating. The whore has then had her hold for various reasons on the religious imagination as a figure of fear, a certain sort of fear. But is she Rome? Is the whore of Revelation 17, can she be read as Rome, a figure for the Roman Catholic Church? Now here, this is kind of an interesting point that Lisa also sort of touches on, which is that some of the readings of the sort of Whore of Babylon as the Roman Catholic Church come from a Reformationist spirit. And this has actually kind of fascinating implications. And Catholics have been threatened enough by the equation of the Church with the Whore of Babylon to refute the equation in great detail. And you can find this on the internet. I mean, sort of 17 reasons why the Whore of Babylon is not or cannot be read as the Catholic Church. I mean, it's kind of funny, but I mean, it raises some very, very interesting points. So sort of how did this tradition come about, especially considering initially the most obvious interpretations of this figure of the whore might be that she stands in for ancient Rome, pagan Rome specifically, right? I mean, the audience that the John of Revelation might have been afraid of, right? I mean, the pagans who are persecuting the early Christians, or Jerusalem. I mean, how did the tradition of equating the whore with Rome, the Roman Catholic Church, come about? Especially since the Roman Catholic Church as such might not really have existed in the moment when John is writing, or John was said to have written this text. So if you think about it, if you look at the King James Version, the whore is said to sit on the seven hills. And, of course, anybody who knows the phrase seven hills of Rome, right, finds that it's really irresistible to say or suggest, well, you know, obviously, you know, this is Rome that we're looking at here, and some institution that sort of presides over the precincts of Rome. But one of the really interesting things, if you look at the Greek of the text, the word for hills, in the word that's translated hills in the King James Version is actually more frequently translated as mountains in the Greek, and this might make a difference because mountains can signify kingdoms, whereas hills, you know, has this more specific Roman feel to it. And while I don't know if the phrase Seven Hills of Rome was current in the time of Shakespeare, at the time of the King James Bible, I would suggest that the very translation sort of embodies the tensions that we're talking about here, the Protestant tensions, sort of looking at sort of Rome as the as the whore. Okay, but, you know, I mean, I could go through all these points, but this would be really boring, why the whore is or is not Rome, okay? It seems to me that the deeper and more interesting question becomes, do Catholics recognize ourselves in any meaningful or useful way in this figure of the Whore of Babylon? And here's where this is both a sort of exhilarating and frightening paper to be trying to deliver here, because I want to argue that while on the one hand she has been useful as a diagnostic tool for ourselves, right? I mean, a symbol of all the things that Lisa alluded to, pride, pageantry, paganism, and excess. In other words, while she can be taken, even by Catholics, as expressive of some of the worst tendencies in Catholic ritual practices and Catholic organized faith, on the other hand, she also, I'm going to argue, embodies some of the most wonderful aspects of Catholic worship and tradition. In other words, the popular piety and colors of the faith that I like and know and love, really. I mean, in other words, the iconic devotionalism that has taken on extraordinary meaning for so many lay Catholics. In other words, let me sort of give you a really concrete example of the problem here. Many of you may have seen the figure of the Magdalene, this sort of Renaissance Italian painting over the altar in the Cathedral of the Madeleine. And I walk into the Madeleine where I work, building I love, and yet I look at her, and she's arrayed in purple and scarlet with gold and precious gems. I mean, is this not the very incarnation of the Whore of Babylon right over the great altar of the Cathedral of the Madeleine? I mean, is this building not the most incredible spectacle? I mean, it's almost inconceivable, right? So on the one hand, this enables me, this figure of the whore, to ask questions. Where did the money for the cathedral come from, right? Is it best sort of employed in the sort of, you know, purchase of Renaissance 16th century paintings as this one is, or should it not in fact be going out the door with the bologna sandwiches to the poor, you know, by way of the program that I work for? So she becomes a symbol of corruption on the one hand of the Catholic Church, but on the other, I have to ask, how much meaning does that corruption really have in the 20th century. I mean, how rich is the Catholic Church now? I mean, what is the meaning, finally, of this image for 20th century Catholics? And the weird paradox is that this sort of image of the Magdalene as Whore of Babylon has perhaps the most meaning for some of the poorest of our parishioners. I mean, that this is part of her absolute splendor and majesty, that it's that you see people who cannot speak English, but yet nevertheless recognize something so Catholic in this image and are satisfied somehow, paradoxically by way of the aesthetic. So, I mean, you know, she's diagnostic, but she's also a figure of extraordinary power in a sort of continuing way. And this is the paradox that I find kind of fascinating about Catholicism. Catholics have always been kind of concerned about sort of iconic devotionalism. And there's a great deal of theological writing done about the question of whether Catholics worship images or not. Okay, it's an extremely touchy topic, as you might imagine. And as it turns out, the Catechism in Latest Incarnation is a great pains to point out that for Catholics, images and spectacle, like this figure of the Magdalene, are windows intended to be windows on the divine, that they are not themselves the divine, that they represent the idea rather than the details of divinity. Okay, there's a real sort of anxiety there to sort of point this out. In other words, the whore, if we can use this idea of the Whore of Babylon to refer to Catholic visual culture, is not important in and of itself as spectacle, aesthetic spectacle, but rather as a sort of image or vision or piety-generating machine. And the Church sees its precedent for this in the Incarnation. I mean, Jesus, on the one hand, Jesus used many symbols and images and figures. And on the other hand, Jesus is himself a physical incarnation of the Word of God. And so Catholics take the Incarnation as precedent for this sort of physical, detailed representation of the divine here on earth. Okay? But there's always an extraordinary anxiety, just as there is in Christian hermeneutical tradition, about the possibility that believers, particularly female or uncivilized believers, might mistake the letter of the law for the spirit of the law, right? The body of the image for the idea the image is supposed to incarnate, right? And it's a long sort of tradition of anxiety in the tradition, and it's often sort of linked with anxiety about female worshipers, uncivilized worshipers, immigrant worshipers, the question of who worships, who has visions, who has access to the truth by way of our tradition. This, I mean, opens on to more general questions that I can only just sort of brush against here, but which I expect have meaning for LDS believers as well as Catholic ones, which is this whole question of what does it mean to have or to worship a vision or an image, especially in the kind of detail or particularity which revelations take on once they become scripture. And as I sort of have been implying, it turns out that it depends who's having it, right? I mean, does the lady allow herself to be had only by certain people, or does the lady allow herself to be had by many people, many times, many ways, many different places, and in, you know, unexpectedly sort of mundane circumstances? This question provokes a lot of sort of restrictive responses, and any of you sort of doubt it, you know, there's a perfect vivid example on 3rd East and 7th South. Perhaps some of you have seen, you know, this, perhaps many of you know, if anybody knows more about this than I do, I'd be fascinated to speak with you. There's a shrine to this apparition of the Madonna on this tree, and it's become basically this sort of Latino property in the city. There's just candles and flowers all over the place. And, of course, the central paradox here, the central Catholic paradox recurs, which is that the Madonna is said to have appeared to fulminate against idol worship, right? And yet, of course, the tree is covered with idols and colors and spectacles and whatnot. And the Church, many priests are currently preaching against this in Salt Lake, okay, that it is perceived as sort of potential actually threatening, right? I mean, that one is not certain what the Catholic sort of stance on this particular outpouring of popular piety is going to be, but one hears these rumblings in the pulpits against this kind of worship. So how am I doing on time? Couple more minutes. I'll try and sort of wrap it up. So in other words, my church at least is fairly schizophrenic on how it sort of addresses the question of visions. Okay, some images are sanctified. Some images are quite the opposite. And more or less it depends on who is having the vision. Who gets to have the vision? Who gets to have the lady, for instance, okay? And very often, this problem turns on questions of worship, popular worship, okay? Lisa sort of spoke about sort of the detail and ornamentation and opulence, this whole set of characteristics which I'm associating with the figure of the Whore of Babylon, as gendered feminine in tradition. I would also argue that these characteristics are associated with the mass, right? Masses, immigrant culture. I mean, not just the detail and ornament and opulence is not, in Catholic tradition, is not just associated with the feminine, but with our status as an immigrant church. And again, if you doubt it, go down there, look at this tree. I mean, you know, this is definitely a Latina Madonna. Okay, and this is part of the problem, that as soon as these images, which make spiritual truths vivid to believers, threaten to make sort of spiritual truths vivid to believers who need to be perhaps controlled, you know, the vision becomes a spectacle from the point of view of official church culture. And that problem interests me a lot. Babylon, always been associated with, you know, the mass and many tongues and languages. And there's no exception in this ongoing sort of Catholic tradition. So, in other words, we have our own tradition of spasmodic reforms of our own whorishness. Okay? I mean, sort of, this love of, you know, opulence can sort of tip into a complete fear and the sense that we need to regulate it. In other words, what becomes important is not what the Madonna, Mary Magdalene, in fact, is seeing here, not her vision. I mean, as soon as you start to sort of worship Magdalene in her vision, right, which after all, you know, she's the first to see the risen Christ, as soon as that sort of becomes too threatening to the official church, she becomes a spectacle, okay, and a thing that needs to be sort of carefully, you know, sort of regulated and watched over. And after all, for Catholics, the whole question of who saw the risen Christ first becomes a question of the apostolic succession and ordination and why, after all, isn't she ordained and so forth. So that I pretty much should wrap it up. But I wanted to conclude by asking some questions about the meaning of material culture in LDS faith, because from the perspective of an outsider, it's very confusing to figure out what this is. In some ways, Mormons seem a lot more Catholic, right, than Catholics. I mean, particularly in relation to the question of God's body, right? And the whole, I mean, God is allowed to have a body in LDS tradition. I would think that would eventuate in sort of articulation of many sort of representations of God's body. And that has been a problem. I mean, you know, Catholics don't believe that God has a body, and yet we are the ones with this sort of whole, you know, tradition of representing God's body. So it's an open question to me, something I'm still trying to learn about the faith. And if anybody would like to ask questions or speak, I hope it wasn't too disorganized here, but I thank you for your ear.
Thank you, Lisa and Marissa. I failed to mention that Marissa has a Harvard degree and also a Columbia degree. Last passed, her PhD was gained in 1996. Now, Lisa, did you want to respond to something, or can we leave this open to questions to you in which you might address any?
I might just say,
the bit that you said about the schizophrenic attitude of the Catholic Church towards its own, yeah. Talk more. Okay.
also I think is embodied in I mean, and I hope that excuse me, my paper helped to sort of elucidate some of those things anyway about Mormonism's own schizophrenia, about images, ritual. I mean, this paper didn't deal with questions of what happens in the temple, but that whole question of sort of like closeting, you know, the ritual, and I, you know, and I don't mean disrespect in saying that, but closeting it in a completely other site and away from everyone, the question of the ritual and the whole question of safeguarding and protecting that ritual so that, you know, only certain people are allowed to sort of like touch on it and articulate it and ornament it and change it. I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, it's, I just think maybe one of the big, big problems of Christianity in general is this question of, yeah, of the body. So that's all I have to say.
Are there questions? Okay, would you repeat this question into the mic?
It's really not a question, but it's a comment in regards to something that you said concerning kind of a dichotomy between our types of worship.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, we have the Mormon plainness, kind of a 19th century, I guess it's in New England, where we come mm-hmm. from the Quaker, Shaker mm-hmm. kind of tradition of plain beauty. And the old religions, the opulence and so on. My experience has been there's an ongoing argument in Jerusalem as to the location of Jesus' crucifixion and burial. And it's been my experience when I've been to those sites, Mormons have a tendency to think that the garden site is more likely to be authentic than, say, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And I've always had the feeling, in spite of the fact that historically the evidence weighs heavier on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but for Mormons, it's been interesting for me. When you go to these two locations, from a Mormon point of view, it's easy to see that we have the peaceful garden sort of setting as opposed to the heavy icons and the ritual and stuff that exists in the Holy Sepulchre. And I thought that was interesting when you mentioned the plainness of our churches and as opposed to, you know, what we may consider the gaudy, the decorative arrangements in some of the older faiths. And I just kind of threw that out as a comment because that had been some of my experience.
I don't know that I can restate that. But I did want to just respond to one of the things you're saying, which is that I think one of the things you're suggesting is that there may be like a built-in aesthetic and hermeneutic, you know, in the way that you, because of your faith, perhaps would interpret those two sites. Which one feels more heimlich?
Well, that's,
you know?
Exactly what I'm saying is,
yeah.
When you come from the background of
right.
Mormon culture, then of course you fit into a peaceful kind of garden setting. It just makes sense to you. And so well, that's kind of a confirming spirit or whatever you want to call it. And that's been my experience, and I found it interesting. And it's just an observation I've made, and what you said concerning the two. You know, our facilities where we do worship, it's an interesting point.
Thanks.
And actually, the whole Catholic immigrant influx in America from Europe would sort of tend to suggest that the site with the icons and the, you know,
sure.
gaudiness was more Heimlich. So, wait a second, it just makes perfect
right.
sense.
Okay, go there and then move.
Do you want us to come up and
yes.
That's
yeah,
good.
Please. And I think we maybe just have time about 2 minutes more and so that others can move on to the next class.
I'll go fast. This is really basic. I didn't go to Harvard or I don't have a degree. I went to BYU to find a husband. And that took me 2 years of hard work. But as a Mormon, being raised as a Mormon, I've always had enormous conflict. I think I was 9 and a half when I figured out it was a church for men. And I always wished that I could be a Catholic. I thought I could be a great Catholic, just a splendid Catholic. And so I'm interested today to hear, I don't know, it's comforting to know that you have conflict as a... a Catholic, and I'd like to thank you for that. You're my first real Catholic.
My name is Dale Clark. I went to Washington to look for a wife, but I do have a degree from Harvard and Columbia. I don't know much about what we've been talking about today. I was taught right from the beginning that ritual and the mysteries, you keep away from them. And I did pretty well at it. And I went to the Vatican on business. I was in military government, supreme headquarters. I was down in Italy with the people who were trying to kill Hitler. Most wonderful group of people I ever met. And they were all tied in with the Vatican, and I found myself commuting to the Vatican. I went in and out of the Vatican like it was a fraternity house. I was welcome. I met the best people, the best friends, among the best I ever had. The only Christmas cards I write, have written for over 50 years, are to Catholics who came out of that era. I talked with some of them confidentially, Monsignor Schoenhauser, who was the man who uncovered and revealed in the letter which told about the invasion of the of Holland, the Low Countries. He had some of the weirdest ideas about Mormons you ever heard. He didn't know I was a Mormon. The Pope did, but he didn't. And he said things that should make you fight mad. You should hit him. But he was one of the nicest people I ever met. And my reaction to him was one of, this guy's going to be embarrassed. I felt sorry for him. When he finds out he's talking to a Mormon, and that Mormon he equated with the one of these Revelations characters, you know, the man's going to be embarrassed. He's one of the nicest people. Had become a good friend of mine. But I'll just tell you this, that there's serious work to be done, and the Catholics and the Mormons and everybody can get together on it. And they do get together. Just let me leave you with this thought. For over 40 years, the Catholic Church, related as it is to the political parties in Germany, have published from one end to the other that the foundation, the co-founder of the Catholic political party, the ruling party of Germany, is a Mormon. And they always say it. They don't say it part of the time. They say it all the time. It's part of the Catholic tradition there now. So I look to these real problems where we can work together and do it enjoyably.